39. Oh, no promises. Hearing us at that close. Let's pray together. It's a blessing to be in your presence and with your people, Father, and to have this wonderful opportunity to conclude this great first book of your book. And so help us see your work to accomplish your great work to rescue us. In Jesus' name, amen. You'll be delighted to know that I'm showing you this slide for the very last time. And we're coming to the end, looking tonight at the fourth of the patriarchs that we've been walking through for the last couple of weeks to wrap up our study of Genesis. And I must say that I come into the class tonight with a lot of frustration. I just love Joseph's story. And so many different ways to go. I think some really great life lessons to be derived there. We could have a class on Joseph, just a preview of something to come. But that is not our purpose in this class. What have we been focused on as we've made our way through Genesis this quarter? Not all the different things we might consider, but what?
The promises,
how the Genesis story helped tell the Bible story and connect to the bigger biblical story. And so I'm going to stay true to that tonight, as much as that frustrates me, because I'm just so fascinated by this particular character. Interestingly, more attention, you can just look at the slide and see the chapters, more attention is given to Joseph's story than any of the other characters. Even like Abraham, more text is given to Joseph than any of the others, which is really, really interesting. And probably his story are some of the most familiar to us. As we work through these last few chapters, I thought of some different ways to structure the material. I saw this in one place and thought it was kind of interesting. You could break his life down into four places he lived, right? Started out at his father's house. That's roughly 37 to 39. And then picking up at 39, he's going to go for a while to Potiphar's house. And that runs up to about 40, and he's going to spend some time in the jailhouse, and then finally, most of the time, he spends in Pharaoh houses. Think of those four houses. They sort of line up and tell us the story of his life. For our purposes tonight, I'm going to use these three words to break the text we're looking at into three pieces. I think this first segment, 39 through 41, I'm going to call this the preparation period. We'll account for that a little bit as we go further through that. And then 42 through 47, the biggest section is this reunion period. Y'all see where that's going, right? And then finally, 48 through 50, I chose the very vivid word deaths, because basically that's how Genesis ends, with two death stories, one getting more attention than the other. So remember, as we go through this, we're thinking about the promises. We're also thinking about the wanderers. I think there's a lot here for that group who originally saw these writings and heard the beginning story for the first time, wandering in the wilderness. I think there's a lot here for that crowd in this particular story. So let's see if we can walk through this and make some sense of all of it. Let's start with these first, what did I give, about four chapters to that, 39 through 41. Call this the preparation period. What's going on in this section, 39, 40, 41? What's happening in those chapters? You can peek.
God's moving Joseph to where he needs him to be.
God is moving Joseph where he needs him to be. Okay, let's unpack that a little bit. Talk about some of the movement. He gets sold into slavery by his brothers and sent to Potiphar's house, where he is enslaved. I saw a hand. Yes?
I was also going to say, it also in a way is the preparation of the other brothers and the positions they would take, you know, as part of the children of Israel, how that all comes to be as well. God is moving them around, although not as obvious as he's doing with Joseph. But there are certainly movements going on with the other brothers and what happens to them as the children of Israel move forward as a group of people.
One of the benefits, I think, of doing what we've done, and that is take this in big sections and look top down at kind of the whole picture, rather than getting caught up in the interesting details of the stories, is that we're able to see the providential work of God going on and how he's positioning things for his next move and putting his plan together. So yes, I think there's a lot of that going on. It becomes clear as we make our way through this. What else is going on during this time period? What do you remember from Bible Glass and the flannel graph?
Potiphar's wife.
We got that. Potiphar's house is where we have that incident with Potiphar's wife and the false accusation she makes that lands him in the jailhouse. Okay, what else?
The dreams of the jailhouse prisoner.
We got the jailhouse dreams, and then...
It's a better flannel graph story than Potiphar's.
Yeah, fascinating to teach Potiphar's wife to third graders. Good luck with that. I'm so glad I don't start at that age. But God bless you guys who do. But there are more dreams. Who else's dreams are in this?
And that's what scripture. I was going to focus on another part. But in Potiphar's house is where Joseph really sort of makes a name for himself as he takes care of his master's possessions and runs that house. He becomes pretty well known at how good he is at doing that. And then Potiphar's wife comes into play, and that's when everything gets messed up.
Yeah, it all appears to fall apart, right? So if that was me and you, and we had a really great job, and we got falsely accused of embezzlement, and they threw us in jail, we would think of that as a setback, right? And I think some people read Joseph's story, think, oh, no, when he moves to the jailhouse, now he's had a setback. And even in the jailhouse, he interprets the dreams, and the guys forget about him. He's left there longer. Another setback.
He
and it's
prospers
not,
even in jail.
I'm sorry?
Sorry, he prospers even.
He does prosper in jail. Now, that is a curious thing I want you to pay attention to, because twice in what is typically a concise book, the Holy Spirit feels the need to give us Joseph's resume. And I think that's interesting. Have y'all noticed that? At the beginning of chapter 39, are you looking there? At the beginning of chapter 39, we're told how he was purchased. Verse 2, how God made him a successful man, how he becomes the number one guy in his house, right? And then you get to the end of the chapter, and that's after the incident with the wife, and he's thrown into jail, and the story repeats itself. We get the resume again. Verse 21, found favors inside the chief jailer, put everything in his charge, and how everything went well with Joseph in charge, right? And we have the dream story in 40 and 41, Pharaoh dreams, and then he's remembered by the cupbearer, and he comes out and interprets Pharaoh's dream, and then is put in an important position over Egypt. The question I want to ask this evening is, okay, those are stories we've been learning from flannel graphs since we were little, if we were raised going to Bible class. The question is, why am I being told this? Why is it important? Why is it here? Why did I need to know about Joseph in Potiphar's house? We'll take a shot at that.
Shows God's providence.
How so?
Well, it shows that God was one, always with Joseph, but two, was using him to fulfill God's purpose throughout Joseph's life.
Okay, we definitely see the providential work of God. That's one of the great things all the way through this closing segment of Genesis, is to watch God work his plan. Thank you. Other thoughts? Yes, sir?
I think the point you just made about his resume is very critical, because it is God who puts him in Potiphar's house and allows him to be successful. Then he moves to the jail. He allows him to be successful. Then where does he end up? In the place that God needs him to be in order to save his children.
And listen to this, and able to do the job. Able to do the job. The math is important here. How old is Joseph when this story starts? How old? He is a teenager, you're right. He's 17 years old. Have any of y'all had a 17-year-old male? Why are y'all laughing? All I got to do is say 17-year-old male, and you're thinking, oh my goodness, I don't even want to let him leave the house. I'm afraid what they might do. Thank you, that is exactly my point. It's a terrifying thing to turn 17-year-old males loose on the pole. All due deference to your very fine 17-year-old male. Okay? I get that. So I want you to think about this. He goes into this as a 17-year-old male. He comes out of it as the number two guy in the entire country who successfully rescues them from famine. How do you get from A to B?
God.
You spend time learning in Potiphar's house, and you spend time learning in prison. And I think what you see God doing in this period is grooming the boy to be a man who can lead. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so now, don't think small, think big. God knows about the famine that's coming. God knows the danger it will pose to the remnant, to the family, right? I feel kind of funny saying the family. It sounds mafia, doesn't it? I really don't mean to imply that, okay? But the family is the key. And so here's this providential work of God going on with an 18-year-old slave boy in the house of Potiphar being prepped and groomed for this key pivotal role. Did you have your hand up, Scott?
Yeah, another, I think, thing about this is that, as you say, this was written during the Exodus. You know, a series of setbacks, God's plan still came to fruition. And maybe it's kind of a reminder that, you know, through a series of setbacks with Judah, with Joseph, whomever, God still accomplished what he said he would accomplish. And, you know, not to lose hope achieving those promises.
I hadn't thought about that, but it's interesting to ponder that through a period of difficulty, Joseph got where God wanted him to be. And boy, they sure needed to know that as they made their way through the wilderness, right? Interesting. Thank you for sharing that. The other thing that I think is important here is these early chapters of his story, 39, 40, 41, also are preparatory, short-term, for getting the nation to Egypt, right? That's a really big deal. They're not supposed to go there anyway. How many times in Genesis have they been told, don't go to Egypt? Abraham goes anyway. Egypt gets into trouble down there. Egypt is trouble for you, right? And the whole family ends up in Egypt. Why is that, and how is that? These pieces that we're getting start putting together that part of the story and setting us up for actually the next book in the series, the Exodus story that is coming. Do you see the promises at work in all of this?
Promise that he would be blessed. He's fulfilled every time. He's blessed wherever he is.
I can't.
Success. You talk about what we teach the little kids. When I teach these lessons, I always point out, he had to keep his faith, even though it looked bad all around him. But notice that God is doing his part. It may not look like it because, okay, he's not removing him from Potiphar's house or removing him from jail, but he's making sure that he's got plenty to eat and he's taken care of and he's prospering and he's being treated okay.
Yeah. I think all of this segment in here is about the promises we've been talking about. You went a little different direction than I was thinking, so I'm going to tag on what you said. We talked about this blessing and curse promise, right? Back in Genesis 12, I will bless those who bless you. Do you see that in these early stories?
Mm-hmm.
What did Potiphar discover pretty quickly with Joseph?
The Lord prospers Joseph.
Yeah, whatever he touches is gold, right? I want him in charge because, well, when Joseph is treated well, everybody does well. And that's part of that blessing promise that he talked about early. You mess with the family, you suffer. You bless the family. I know it sounds mafia. I thought about that the whole time I was prepping the class. You bless the family, God blesses you. That's the way it is all the way through this. The land is wrapped up in this, guys. The whole land drama is weaving its way into this part of the story. And the bigger issue of the blessing that's got to come through the family. Just as Abraham had to have a child for the blessing to come through him, the nation has to survive, or the family at this point has to survive in order for Christ to come through them. And there's a really serious crisis looming. We don't understand that. If there is a famine in some part of the United States today, like no crops and they can't grow food, what do?
Ship it in.
We ship some food over there to those people, right? In fact, even in other places of the world, relief can be sent to rescue people in a famine. What happened to if you were living in a famine at that time that maybe went on for years? You died. And I think one of the things that becomes clear as we go through this story, that is exactly what is at stake, that the famine is going to be so terrible that Abraham's family wasn't going to survive without some intervention from God. And so you mentioned providence, Troy. I think you see the providence. God didn't make it miraculously rain bread from heaven as he is in the wilderness. But he is going to take care of them and get them through this. By the way, lesson for the wanderers in that. What are they griping about as they're going through the wilderness? Yeah, where's the food? What about water? And God is saying, do you know anything about your history? Have you read Genesis, right? I've been here before. I've taken care of the family. I could take care of you too. Yes, sir.
One of the things about the time in Egypt is it allowed them to grow in population, which was going to be very strategic when they head back to the land. Because as a small little family of Abraham's clan, it wasn't going to do much to take over a land that God had, you know, position for them. It was going to take thousands of them.
Right.
And the time in Egypt allowed them to grow that population to be able to take on that task that God had in mind for them.
And that is exactly what happens. They grow to be a great nation. That is what Jacob is told when, I think it's 42, when he's reluctantly going because his son is there, and God says, don't worry. You're going to go there, and you're going to become a great nation there. So all of this early stuff, I know it's really cool. I have a whole sermon I preach about temptation from Joseph and Potiphar's wife. And I think that's a perfectly legitimate lesson to teach. But it's a secondary, a tertiary lesson. It's not the primary lesson. Primary lesson is that God is preparing. He is preparing Joseph for the role of saving the family of promise. Does that make sense? Okay, so that's 39 through 41. Let me pick up at 42 through 47. This is our biggest segment, and I called this segment Reunion because... there's going to be a family reunion. And you thought your Thanksgiving was awkward, right? Nobody tried to sell you into slavery as a child. And that's what's getting ready to come together here. So I want to point you to 41, if you'll go there in your Bible. Look at the end of 41. Because the end of 41 and the beginning of 42 connect this Egypt story that's been developing right since 39. It connects the Egypt story now with the bigger Bible story. So look at verse 53. Now remember, Joseph interprets Pharaoh's dreams about the 7 good years and then the 7 years of famine. And so we're picking up the story at verse 53. After the years of plenty have passed, verse 53 said, when the 7 years of plenty which had been in the land of Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come, just as Joseph had said, then there was famine in all the lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. So when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried out to Pharaoh for bread. Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph, whatever he says to you, you shall do. When the famine was spread over all the face of the earth, then Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, and the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. Look at verse 57. The people of all the earth came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe in all the earth. So, I mean, this is a huge natural disaster. This isn't a localized Egypt thing. Throughout all of that region, we all know the reaches of that, but whatever. Throughout all that region, you got people suffering from this famine. And so, picking up at 42, now Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, and Jacob says to his son, why are you staring at one another? He said, behold, I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us from that place so that, listen to this, so that we may live and not die. So question now, do you see the intersection of the two stories? The famine is spread to all the earth. And what verse 42 tells us, or chapter 42 rather, tells us, is that it has reached out and it has touched the family of Abraham, right? In fact, Jacob says, if we don't get some food, we're going to die, right? And so he says to his sons, why are y'all standing around here? why don't y'all go to Egypt and buy food? Question, do you think the brothers knew about the food in Egypt?
Probably.
It's hard to imagine that old decrepit dad knows that there's food in Egypt. And the young bucks don't know that there is food in Egypt. So why did it not dawn on Reuben or Judah? We should go to Egypt and get some food.
They would have to do something.
Sorry?
They would have to do something.
Okay, but that's better than dying.
But they well, Egypt's never a good place to go happen. For that family. And nothing good comes out of Egypt.
They knew they'd sold their brother and he was sold there, so they might run
into it. So if you read through this segment, one thing that becomes crystal clear is these guys have not forgotten about their brother. And they've matured some, and they're really bothered about what they had done. I don't think they wanted anything to do. I don't think they wanted to go there. And they have to be nudged by, he's like, okay, guys, you got to go or we're going to die. It's one way or the other. And so they reluctantly go, but I think that is really, really interesting, because all the way through this, it is like Joseph is the ghost that is haunting them. I'm saying that figuratively, not literally. I did not advocate ghosts, okay? You hear me say that. But I am saying that they are bothered by what they've done to their brother. And I just wondered, it's curious to me in 42, Jacob is the one that seems to know the foods in Egypt. He's the one urging them to go down there. So, if they've got to go to Egypt to buy food, what's getting ready to happen? A family reunion, yeah. And suddenly, the Egypt story is about to intersect dramatically with the bigger Bible story and the family. And so, this is where it really, really gets fascinating. Joseph will be the one they have to meet with. Is this like a Hollywood plot or what? They have to actually go before him and request to buy the food. By the way, does that ring a bell? The brothers having to go before him, right? Isn't that amazing how those things come to pass? So, one of the parts of the story that makes this fascinating is that he recognizes them and they don't recognize him. Why do you think that is?
Dressed like an Egyptian.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
He's dressed like an Egyptian.
He probably
he's
also an dressed
Egyptian
as royalty.
Haircut and all of that. He's, yeah.
Well, he was also really young when they sold him into slavery, so yeah. He's probably changed a lot more than they have.
You know, we can roughly calculate some years here, but think 20 years, right? So it may have even happened like today when with families visiting that you were looking across at someone who grew up here 20 years ago and you're thinking, oh my goodness, is that them? They look so old. What happened, right? And I think that's what happened with Joseph is he has grown up, right? And is not dressed as they would expect him to be dressed. Why would this guy be running Egypt, right?
Yeah. They would have never expected the 17-year-old they sold into slavery, who's now 37, which if they're, like, let's say that they're, like, when they sold him, he's 17, so there's going to be a lot more change in someone going from 17 to 37 than someone going from, like, 30. Like, it's just a difference.
After 50, you don't age at all.
You just stop aging.
You just stop. That's absolutely true.
But it is a lot, like, in stature, like, how a man is going to
oh,
grow
absolutely.
In size.
Yes.
Like, there's so many things beyond just, like, what his face will look like, you know, with having the haircut and the clothing, whatever. Like, he's gone from, like,
A boy to a man,
literally.
Exactly. And so I'm not really surprised that they don't recognize each other. But that's what makes this kind of fun, right? Because he knows, and they don't know. And so much of this section, from 42 to 47, is this sort of odd reconnection where Joseph seems to toy with them, if it might not be better to say, torment them during this period. And it's interesting, the Holy Spirit just goes into some detail. I mean, look at 42 in verse 9. He's accusing them of being spies. How that must have freaked them out. And then he says, you know, he gets their family story and says, I want you to go get Benjamin. And how odd was that? You know, this Egyptian who thinks we're spies is now prodding us about our family. And then he revises the test, and he says, one of you has to stay, and the others of you go get Benjamin. And then he puts the money back in their bag. How about, oh, think how bizarre that was. Going back to dad, more money, less kids. Have we heard that story before? Don't you know they're talking all the way back? How do we explain this to dad? I mean, we've already done this before, right? And here they are showing up, missing a kid, and with more money again. How does that work, right? So what do we do with this toying that Joseph is doing here? What's that all about? What do you think?
Well, I've never thought of it as toying. I've always thought of it as testing. But maybe I'm too generous to Joseph. I understand some people don't see it that way. But for me, Joseph was deeply hurt. His brothers threw him in a pit and sold him into slavery. And so he wants to know, have these guys changed? Have they matured? And are they going to do the same thing to their other, how are they treating my little brother Benjamin? Do they love my dad? And have they had any remorse? Have they grown? I've grown. Have they? And so I think it's, and you set it up exactly right. He sends them back the same way they went back when they threw him in the pit. They've got more money and a missing son.
Yeah.
And so they have to go back. And that dichotomy is it's a test.
So
and
if
I
you
think
look
it's
at
a beautiful test.
If you look at 42, I think it's pretty clear that Joseph isn't being mean to them. In fact,
he's crying.
I mentioned to you earlier about how troubled they are about what they've done to Joseph. And oddly enough, it's on their heart. If you look toward the end of, toward the middle of 42, as Joseph is pressing them about bring the youngest back and all of that, look at 21. It says, then they said to one another, truly we are guilty concerning our brother. Do you see it? Because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, yet we would not listen. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. Verse 22, Reuben answered them, saying, did I not tell you? Told you guys this was going to happen. Do not sin against the boy, and you would not listen. Now comes the reckoning for his blood. I love that. Reuben says, I told y'all. I told y'all this was going to happen. You always have someone in the family that does that, right? But look at 23. They did not know, however, that Joseph understood, for there was an interpreter between them. He turned away from them and wept. So I think there is other data here that indicates he's not a bad player. As much as we are tempted to think he's toying with him, I think you're right. I don't think that's what he's doing. I think he's trying to find out, has anything changed with him? We have to remember, I think we forget this sometime, that Joseph doesn't have all the cards. Joseph doesn't know anything about what the brothers went back and told their dad, about their dad's belief that he had died. Don't you think he wondered why dad never came and got him? Think about that. So there's a lot of missing pieces for him, and I think what he's doing here is he's trying to fill in the missing pieces. And in particular, and I think you're right about this, I think he wants to know if his brothers have had a change of heart. Because if you skip ahead to 44, I know we're jumping over some of the detail in this. That's what time forces us to do. But if you jump ahead to 44, beginning at verse 18, this is after they come back and they bring Benjamin. And Joseph sets Benjamin up to be the fall guy. The king's cup's in his bag. Now he's going to be the one who's going to suffer the consequences. Verse 18, who speaks up?
Judah.
The one who said, the one who started this by saying, let's not kill him, let's sell him and make some money. That was Judah, right? And Judah's the one who speaks up. And I won't read the whole speech here, but it's really impressive. There's just this impassioned speech about, you don't know what this is going to do to our dad. We've already done this once before. And if we come back and tell him Benjamin is captive or dead, our father will not survive. And so then Judah actually offers himself in his brother's place. He said, you take me and send my brother home. And then he knows, right? he realizes these are not the same men. In fact, the script has been flipped. Judah is actually willing to sacrifice himself for the purpose of saving, for saving Rachel's last boy. Think about that. And that bitter family. It was a dramatic, it was a dramatic moment. And that brings us to 45, where Joseph finally reveals himself, and now it's all connected together, right? Now you have the family reunion. There are some important things that are said in 45. I want you to note a couple of them with me. I'm going to begin reading in verse 5. This is right after he announces himself. By the way, I love the end of verse 3 when he says, I am Joseph, is my father still alive? And his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. Maybe one of the greatest understatements in all of Scripture. Who's got the sword? So, you know, they're worried about who's coming after them. Listen to what Joseph said, though, verse 5. I love this. Now, do not be grieved or angry with yourself because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. By the way, now do you see the connection to the promise? Do you see it coming together? For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there's still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Now, therefore, it is not you who sent me here, but God. Do you see what he's saying there? I'm curious how he knows this, how he has put this together, but he has the whole story now. The Messiah's family is in danger of dying, and God has worked all this out. He has positioned me so that I could deliver all of you.
It's interesting that he arrives at that point while his brothers have spent this time clearly feeling guilty about, oh, we got to go back to Egypt. It's like, is he going to, whatever. Like, they've, like, that was their, like, that was their thought, while at the same time, Joseph has, like, grown through this and come to the conclusion, like, God put me here. He set me up for this.
I hadn't thought about the odd irony of I am Joseph to them, meaning there's about to be some dying, right? And Joseph comes back and said, no, there's going to be some living as a result of all of this. Yes?
One other thing that's kind of interesting in the story of what's not there, not a word of Pharaoh. Where's Pharaoh in all of this? I mean, does he even know this is all going on? I mean, Pharaoh...
Well, he does because of verse 2. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it and the household of Pharaoh heard of it. So, I mean... Is this a big deal to Pharaoh? I don't know.
I don't know. It just seems odd that, you know, he put everything in Joseph's hands and said, you go see Joseph if you want to get taken care of. Then all this drama's happening, right? And king's cups are leaving and people are coming back. And it's just a soap opera.
It is.
Pharaoh's like going, I don't know what in the world's going on, but I guess Joseph will take care of it, you know, so.
The other thing that I think is really important in 45, if you look at verse 8, what he says to his brothers is, rather than harming them, I'm going to protect you. There's more famine to come. The family needs to survive. So I'm going to bring you here and do that. And then if you pick up in verse 40, or chapter 46, because they're going to Egypt. And that's so counterintuitive, right? In Exodus. And the interesting thing is, Jacob seems to struggle with that. Rightly so. And so if you look at 46 and verse 1, so Israel set out with all that he had, and it came to Beersheba, offered sacrifices to God, the God of his father, Isaac. Look at verse 2. God spoke to Israel in vision of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. He said, here am I. He said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. Do you see it? So, don't be afraid to go. I'm doing this to preserve you and Randy, I think you said that earlier, to do the nation building down in Egypt. So as we begin to head out of 47 in the family reunion and really get to the end of the book, things are askew. They're not as they're supposed to be. Do you see that? They are not supposed to be in Egypt. Where are they supposed to be? They're supposed to be in Canaan. In fact, that's been the message all the way through Genesis. So we get to the end of the book, and they are not there. not where they are supposed to be. I'm hoping that the wanderers, as they read that, had that same notion. Egypt is not where we're supposed to be. Because all through the journey of the wilderness, what were the wanderers saying?
Let's go back to Egypt.
You need to go back to Egypt. Yes. It was better in Egypt. And the message of Genesis is, Egypt is not where you're supposed to be. So we get to this weird place at the end of the book where that's exactly where they are. All right, for the sake of time, I'm going to press on to these last three chapters, 48, 49, and 50. And two deaths. Who dies at the end of the story?
Or Israel and Joseph.
Jacob, Israel, and Joseph. Oddly enough, though, whose death gets the attention? Yes. So Jacob reemerges as the primary character for the end of the book, which is kind of odd. We've thought the story's about Joseph all the way through. In fact, guys, I'm not sure who the main character is. Joseph is certainly a key player all the way through here, but you know what? Judah is a pretty important character who seems to come up all the way through. And Jacob reemerges here at the end. He's going to really be the main character through the rest of the book. So interesting that all of them are at play here. Let me just sketch these last three chapters for you. In 48, as his death draws near, Jacob's going to have a series of meetings. In 48, he's going to meet with Joseph and two of his boys, his two oldest boys. In 49, he's going to meet with all of his boys. And then in 50, we're going to be told about his funeral because he dies at the end of 49. And Joseph's death is going to be mentioned, but only very briefly. Isn't that interesting, by the way? In terms of Earth's perspective, whose death would have been really important? Think about that. From Egypt's perspective, whose death would have been really important? Yeah, Joseph, it's the vice president died, right? That's going to be on the news. We're going to get like 8 hours of funeral coverage for that one, right? Whose death gets all the attention here? Jacob's does. Because from heaven's perspective, he's the one through whom the promise goes. So, interesting. Earth and heaven don't always line up.
It really multiplies too because he has 12 sons. And then it really starts to multiply.
Yeah, that is exactly right. So let's walk through the meetings real quick. In 48, if you'll look there, he has this meeting with Joseph's sons that frankly is just weird. I mean, just weird on so many levels. If you read this, you saw that. First of all, have we encountered this before? Dying fathers, at least allegedly dying fathers, meeting with sons to do blessing stuff. Where do we see that before? Yes, remember that Isaac tries to do this with Esau to do an end around on God, right? That was that earlier story we talked about. Same kind of deal going on here, and really some bizarre similarities with the Isaac and Jacob and Esau story, and now Jacob and his sons. There's blindness, there's blessing, and he gets the boys mixed up, right? He winds up giving the blessing to the younger, which gives him he gets it all. Joseph isn't happy about it, but you know, Dad says, I've done what I've done, which is what dads typically say, right? So interestingly, the other thing that he does here is he adopts Joseph's two oldest boys, Manasseh and Ephraim. Do those names ring familiar? We talk about the tribes of, they're listed, right? Ephraim and Manasseh. Those were not sons of Jacob or sons of Israel. They were Joseph's sons, but they're adopted by Jacob and they become two of the named tribes. The question is, why does he do that?
For his firstborn.
That's what it is. But why does Jacob choose to adopt two of Joseph's boys?
God tells him.
Sorry?
God tells him.
Well, if it's in the text, I didn't see that.
So
I don't think we know. So my brain goes two different directions. Is this one more shot at his favorite? He's my favorite. He's getting special stuff. I don't know. Or is it a special blessing out of gratitude because they saved the nation?
But isn't that kind of interesting, though? Because you would think that Jacob would want to really promote Joseph for doing what he did, but he didn't really promote Joseph so much as
the
he
boy.
Did his sons, which makes you kind of question sort of the relationship between the father and Joseph. There was admiration, there was thankfulness, there was love and all that. But the promise part of that doesn't seem to really kind of play out here the right way.
I don't know, though. Joseph, I think, seems pleased. He's not pleased that he gets the boys backwards.
I think that was traditional in that society, though. You honor the father by honoring
the sons.
So he gave him a double portion. He treated Joseph like he was the oldest.
There are several things that happen here that are curious to me that are done without explanation, and so I'm left curious about them. The other thing that happens is that Jacob gives him a piece of property. Did you notice that? He gives him a piece of property in Canaan. And don't ask me to account for that, because I find the property and how he came to have it a mystery too. There's some question about all of that. The more curious question to me is, why does Jacob give this boy, Joseph, a piece of property in the promised land?
Wasn't it the only piece of property that they actually owned?
No, this is a different spot. It's not the Cave of Machpelah. That's going to come up again in a minute.
Yeah, because this comes from the Amorite.
Yeah, this is another piece of property. I have wondered if perhaps for his most Egyptian son, giving him a little piece of the promised land was a reminder.
It really is.
Yeah. I know you're tied down pretty well in Egypt.
Abraham.
This is not your home. This is not where it's supposed to be.
One other question. Could this also have something to do with the fact that Joseph was married to an Egyptian woman and not to a daughter of Israel, if you will? And that was sort of frowned upon. I mean, we all understand the circumstances of why that happened, but that was sort of outside the realm of what God wanted to have happen.
Well, that's certainly true and never addressed either.
Right.
So that's, again, all this is intriguing to me because it just happens. He adopts the two boys. He gives them the piece of land, but we're just told that he does, and we're not told why. And I told y'all going into this class that the Bible frustrates me a lot because I'm curious. I'd like to know a little more about that. And God says, well, I'm not going to tell you, right? So, anyway, that's the meeting with Joseph and his boys. In 49, there is the traditional fatherly meeting with Jacob and all of the boys. Interestingly, chapter 49 sort of bookends this with purposes. We're told a little while it happened. So, if you will look at verse 1, this is 49. Then Jacob summoned his sons and said, assemble yourselves that I may tell you what will befall you in the days to come. So one of the things we learn in, he's about to say something that will be prophetic in nature. Here's what's coming in the future for you. And then if you go to 28 toward the end, he said all of these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father said to them when he blessed them. And so there's some future associated with this, and there's some blessing associated with this. Though, to be candid with you, when you read what he says to some of the boys, it doesn't sound much like blessing, right? So
it says in 28, appropriate to him.
Well, there you go. That's exactly right. He still calls it blessing, though, and I'm thinking, that's probably generous a little bit with that. We could do a whole class just kind of walking through all of these. I think Judah, if I was going to point you to one to really pay attention to, it's the promise to Judah. I think there are some messianic overtones. Remember, he is the one for whom the promise is going to flow. So that one's important to take special note of. For the sake of time, I want to point you to something in verse 29 that I think is especially important. After he gives a statement or a blessing or a warning to each of the boys, in 29, here's what he says. I am about to be gathered to my people. It's a nice way of saying I'm getting ready to die. bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought along with the field from Ephron the Hittite for a burial site. There they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah. There they buried Isaac and his wife Rebekah. There they buried Leah in the field and the cave that is in it, purchased from the sons of Heth. Oh my goodness, that is a lot of words to say, bury me where you buried daddy and granddaddy, right? So tell me about this. Why is this important? Why is he so emphatic about it?
That's the promised land.
Yes, and where are they now?
Egypt.
Egypt.
So it needs to be returned to the promised land.
Why does Jacob want to be sure he's buried in the promised land?
Those are going back eventually.
That's home for the nation. And so I think it's really significant at the end of his life here that he presses his family. You do not find a burial site for me in Egypt because we are only here temporarily. You take me back to the land and you bury me there because that is where our future is. This is land stuff, folks. Do you see the way the promises are threading all the way through this? This is land stuff. This is about inheriting the land that God promised. Yes, sir.
They were also, again, this is written near the Exodus, they were carrying Joseph's bones with them. So there's...
You did, but that's okay because when we get to the end of Joseph's life, if there were ever a question about whether or not his roots were in Egypt, he tells his brothers the same thing. I want you to take my bones with you. In fact, that's sort of his parting testimony to the nation. You carry me along whenever you leave. And so think about that. All during the listen, the people who are reading this. There are people reading this whose job it was to lug around the coffin that carried the bones of Joseph. And here's the reason why. And now that's explained for them in Genesis. There is one other thing that I think is really cool here that I don't want to miss. Notice he talks about who is buried in this spot, right? Abraham and Sarah, right? Isaac and Rebekah. And who else is buried here?
Leah.
Rachel. Who is not buried here?
Rachel
is not buried here. So in death, it's going to be Jacob and Leah. You see, she got in the end what she never had in life. She is the one buried with her husband in the family burial site.
Well, she's also the mother of the lineage to Christ.
To me, it's redemption. Because I think if you look at the whole story of the two women, Leah's definitely a more noble character than Rachel is. And she ends up buried with her husband. Yes, ma'am?
So we're not told about the other brother's death, but when he died, Joseph died, he talked to his brothers, and he think he died before his brothers?
Can't answer that. It is certainly possible that some of his actual, Benjamin, for example, but it could also be that by brothers he's referencing family and what the family wants to do with him. But I think it's probable that Benjamin is still alive at that time. So brothers doesn't necessarily mean all of them. The last thing we have in chapter 50 is the rather elaborate burial of Jacob. Some detail given about all of that. Evidently, there's some Egyptian customs that are followed. They talk about that in verse 2. The physicians embalm him. And then they get to get permission of Pharaoh to bury him back in Canaan, who signs off on that. And then Egypt supplies them with what they need. There's a whole entourage that goes down there. It's interesting that it was the Egyptians who brought them into the land, and now the Egyptians who are carrying Jacob back to his homeland. Great grief, there's record of that and how the neighbors notice all of that. Just before we're out of time, why are we being told all of this about his, mainly his burial? I mean, really, if you look at that, It's not a story about his funeral. We don't know who spoke and how long they went on and what they said about him. The story is how they took him and buried him. Why is that important?
Land.
Sorry?
It's all about the land.
It's all about the land promise. Do you see that? It's all the way through the story.
Is it a bit of a type for the Exodus too? Israel out of Egypt into the promise.
I will tell you this. I thought about the wanderers as I'm reading this. And again, that nagging propensity to say, we were better off in Egypt. We should go to Egypt. And what Genesis does to the wanderers, it says, you look back at the father of the nation, Israel, the father whose name you bear. And what did he say about this? There's great attention given to that. I think to communicate to the wanderers, Canaan is where we belong. This is where our forefathers are buried. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. It's where you need to be buried too. And then the cherry on the top of all of that at the end is Joseph says, me too. You take me and you bury me there too. Enjoyed the class very much, folks. Thanks for your help along the way. Hope it was a valuable study for you. And by the way, someone needs to teach Exodus next because we're all wrapped up, ready to go there, right?